Major General Hobart, Reel 2. General, you were saying about the opinion of your crew in the last reel. What was your main maintenance problem with the Mark 6s?
Oh, heavens. I really can't answer this question because I simply can't remember. They were fairly temperamental as far as I can remember. And one was fairly frequently having to having track trouble and suspension trouble, having to change bogies and that sort of thing. But as far as I can remember, the troubles were mostly with suspension rather than with the engine or transmission. And that's about as much as I can remember.
Did you take part in exercises, manoeuvres during this period?
Oh yes. We used to have local exercises, which of course obviously were a bit limited because of tanks on the roads and tracks and so on. But we also used to foregather down at Salisbury Plain in the summer for higher level training down there. But I only had, once I joined the battalion, which was in the summer of, no, it must have been the early part of 1938, I suppose, because I was commissioned in August 37. We went, as far as I remember, the battalion moved down to Warminster, to the new barracks at Warminster, which had been custom built for the Royal Tank Corps, for two battalions of the Royal Tank Corps. And we must have moved down there, I suppose it was the beginning of 39, and therefore there was really only one season in which we could have exercised before we moved down to Warminster. And quite honestly, I can't remember what the hell we did that summer in the way of exercise.
Would you remember any tactical aim or objective of the exercises?
No, not at that time, because all I can say is that my impression now, looking backwards, is that everything we did at that time was orientated towards, or rather stemming from, the sort of modus operandi and tactical doctrine which had been hammered out during the earlier days that I was talking about, the earlier days of the 2nd Battalion, when it was commanded by my uncle, and the original tank brigade days in 34-35.
Did you, for example, use this purple primer?
Well, no, I know the name of purple primer, but I don't think I've ever clapped eyes on the volume. I certainly don't recall ever opening its cover. I presume that it contained the tactical doctrine which I've just been referring to. But I certainly don't remember studying it.
Were you not aware then of any sort of doctrinal debate going on at this time?
Oh yes, one was aware. One was aware that the whole business about armour and the armoured arm and armoured tactics and philosophy of armoured warfare and so forth was very much in the melting pot, and I was particularly aware of this because I knew that my uncle had been battling for this cause for many years, and battling against a fairly formidable opposition too at times. So I was aware of it, but you know, one's horizon as a second lieutenant commanding a section of light tanks is somewhat bounded.
Did he at this time discuss any of this with you?
No, I don't think so, because by this time he was no longer commanding the tank brigade. He was no longer, as far as I can recall, Director General of Fighting Vehicles, or whatever the appointment was called. in the War Office or Director of Military Training. And I think he must have, if he hadn't gone, he was on the verge of going off to Egypt, I think, at this time. In any case, I didn't see, at this time, I didn't see very much of him, as far as I remember. And my father also, by this time, had retired from India, and so we had a home in England, to which I naturally went on my leaves and things. And therefore, I didn't see so much of the old man as I had before.
Did you, on the exercises and during your almost daily routine with the battalion at this time, did you use firing on the move as a...
No. firing on the move was not really a practical proposition at that time, because firing on the move only rarely became a practical proposition with the introduction of the stabilizer, which is, you know, wasn't until many, many years later. I don't remember when the stabilizer actually was brought in, but in fact I can't remember even if it was in by the end of the Second World War. But it certainly, to answer your question, no, there was no, as far as I recall, there was no question of firing on the move in those days.
Did you do any gun practice?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. We had an annual, each battalion had an annual gunnery camp at Lulworth, where all the tanks were fired and the gunners qualified and so on. And this was a big event. But we had to go to Lulworth to do it. Apart from the Vickers machine gun, which we could fire within our own barracks on the 30-yard range. But everybody had to go to Lulworth once a year. And it was a highlight of the... It was one of the highlights, anyway, of the year's training. Great fun.
During the period that you were with the 2nd Battalion, it went down to Warminster.
That's right.
To a purpose-built barracks.
That's right.
Could you just say a little bit about that?
Yes. Yes. What I say about it is that it was a wonderful, marvellous place. The barracks were absolutely brand new, off the good buildings and well appointed, and the 2nd Battalion and the 3rd Battalion shared the barracks, and it was custom built for two tank battalions with hard standings and workshops and washdowns and all that sort of thing, and a very nice mess, which consisted of a central part and two wings, and the 2nd Battalion officers lived in one wing and the 3rd Battalion officers in the other, and we shared the common facilities in the middle. And it was right on the edge of Salisbury Plain, as you know, which was in those days comparatively undeveloped. And there was nothing there at all except just the barracks on the edge of the plain underneath the whatever hill it is, Battlesbury Hill, I think it's called. And it was absolutely gorgeous, lovely, lovely place. And right on the edge of the training area and so on. Very good.
What would you say was the main advantage then from where you've just come from?
Oh, well, Farnborough really was, as it is now, sort of almost suburban. And there were no training areas there except for Laffan's Plain, which you shared with everybody else. And well, the advantages of Warminster, I suppose, really were threefold. One was that it was a lovely, beautiful Wiltshire countryside. Secondly, that there were absolutely brand new barracks, very well appointed. And thirdly, that we were there by ourselves, just two tank battalions, and that was all, and nobody else. Three pretty big advantages.
What was the other battalion?
The third battalion were a tank corps.
You were technical adjutant at this time at Warminster.
Yes, I was, that's right, yeah.
Would you describe some of the main things you were doing?
Well, my main job was this is before war was declared. And indeed, I suppose after it was declared for a bit. But my main job really was to receive new equipment as it came into the battalion, and to train soldiers on it to make sure that the maintenance of it was properly understood and was properly carried out, to supervise the workshops and repair of vehicles, both in the field, out on the plain when they came to grief, and in workshops in barracks. And also, that's right, driver training. I mentioned that in the training of drivers. And of course, the training of the fitters, people who worked in the workshops, which then were all our own regiment, you see, the all the days of the weaving. People, they wore our own
gear. What were the AFEs that you were working on then?
Well, here again, I can't, my memory is not very clear, but the old Vickers medium tank, which the standard equipment was that time at long last, just phasing out, and being replaced by three tanks. One is called the A9, which had, its characteristic was that it had two what were called dustbin turrets on the port bow and starboard bow, which were desperately uncomfortable and had a Vickers machine gun in each. The A10, which was much the same as far as I can remember, except that it didn't have the two dustbin turrets. And the A13, which was a slightly new conception in so much as it had a new suspension with very big wheels, and it was much faster and a much more sophisticated machine altogether. Those three new medium tanks were coming in to replace the old Vickers, which had been going since just after the First World War. And then we also had the light tanks, Mark VI and Mark VIB, as well, the Vickers light tanks, with which we went to war.
As technical adjutant, what was your main problem with the new equipment that was coming, the A9s, 10s, 13s?
Do you know, I honestly couldn't tell you. I really don't remember.
Behind my question was the fact that the A13, for example, had this Christie suspension.
That's right. This is what I was referring to, the big wheels.
Yeah. Did you find any mechanical problems about that?
I remember that this Christie suspension is, at least I vaguely remember, this Christie suspension, as you probably know, depended on a long sort of oleo arm, which was pivoted and which took up the shock and suspension. And we did have a lot of trouble with those. A great deal of many replacements of those was one of the sort of standard tasks which one faced with fairly often. But that's as far as my technical memory goes.
Would you have said, appreciating what you've just said, would you say that the A13 was superior, much superior to the other two?
It was, to us, a very sophisticated machine, and of course it was very exciting to drive because it was much faster than anything we had before, and you could drive it across country with suspension giving you a ride which one wouldn't believe was possible in the old tanks with small wheel suspension. But I don't know. What exactly was your question?
I was asking you what you felt was the main differences between this A13
and
the other two.
Well, I would say two things. One, sophistication, and two, speed. And with speed, of course, goes its ride across country, because you can't have the speed without a reasonable ride.
Did you think at the time that these new tanks coming in were the answer to...
Yeah, I'm pretty near, brother, yes.
They met what you felt at the time was a need?
We did, I think, yes. I certainly, perhaps I was very naive, but I certainly remember thinking this was tremendous, Danny, but of course what one didn't take into account, what one learned so bitterly afterwards, was that the only thing that really matters is the armament.
General, you were saying about the armament on the A-13. What do you remember of your reactions to that at the time?
Well, I can't remember, in fact, the details of what the armament was, but because I was, as technical adjutant, I was much more concerned, of course, with the automotive side rather than the gunnery side. But I suppose it must have been either a 2, 3, or 6 pounder. I don't think it could have been a 2, so it must have been a 3 or 6 pounder, but I honestly can't remember. All I do remember is that we learned fairly soon in the Western Desert that the armament with which our tanks were provided then was outgunned and outranged by the Germans, at least, as soon as they arrived, if not by the Italians before. And this was, of course, I suppose, the most vivid lesson that any of the early Western Desert tank people remember.
Yes. Did you, at the time, were you aware of anti-tank developments at all?
No, I didn't think we were, because it was... Really, in those days, there was only one anti-tank weapon, and that was the ground anti-tank gun, or the anti-tank gun carried in the tank. And the days of bazookas and anti-tank missiles had not arrived, had not dawned.
While you were at Warminster in 1939, the formation occurred of the Royal Armoured Corps. How did that affect you personally?
Not a scrap. Not a scrap. Except that sections became troops and companies became squadrons and battalions became regiments overnight. I suppose, yes, it must have been at that moment also that we ceased to be the Royal Tank Corps and became the Royal Tank Regiment within the Royal Armoured Corps. That's all part of that, didn't affect us at all. Well, not at my level.
Yes. What was your reaction to it? Did you like it? Did you like the idea?
Well, I think it seemed an eminently sensible and logical thing to do. It was obvious there was going to be enormous expansion. It was obvious that the cavalry were going to be completely mechanized, and it was equally obvious that the logical thing therefore would be to have an armored corps embracing all units of the armored arm.
Between that time and the outbreak of war, was there any cavalry units sent to Warminster for any training?
No, not as far as I remember. All I can say is not as far as I remember.
Yes. What do you think of this popular idea that the cavalry were reluctant, or there's a sort of hostility towards the mechanization program?
Well, here again, I can't speak from really from personal experience, because I was too young at the time to impinge upon me. I have considerable experience of the cavalry since the war, since those days. I would think that, of course, there was a natural reluctance for them to give up their horses, to give up their way of life, and their special position in the British Army, and in the many years, centuries of history, to give all this up for a complete change of, not only of equipment, but change of role, too. It was very natural that they should be resented, I think, and I can quite understand that. Having said that, of course, once the thing was accepted, they, or at least the many of them, and the better regiments, got stuck into it, and were absolutely first class. But I can't say more than that because my impressions really are based on hindsight rather than, or rather hind knowledge rather than remembrance of the time.
May I return just to your technical additions job in relation to the new equipment you were receiving?
Mm.
Did you have to report back to anybody on the performance of the vehicles?
Only to my commanding officer, as far as I remember.
Yeah.
I mean, there, I suppose there were a certain number of... obviously, there were some technical reports which had to be made. I've no doubt to... I can't think who quite, but... to whatever part of the organization it was then that was responsible for supplying the new equipment. But by and large, no, my job was to get to know the new machines, to train people to use them and look after them, to see that the fitters knew how to mend them, and generally to familiarize the regiment with them. And I was responsible to my commanding officer for the, in all that appeal, not to anybody else.
Were you doing any training of crews in the new equipment?
Oh, yes, rather, yes. That was a very, very essential part of the acceptance of the new equipment.
How were they allocated within the company?
Oh, I can't remember. I think, well, there are really two ways one can do it. One can either equip one squadron at a time complete, or else one can... equip all three squadrons simultaneously so that the equipment and the know-how is spread throughout the regiment at the same time. And which of these two methods we adopted, I really can't remember now.
Yeah.
Maybe a mixture of both.
What about communications? Was there a noticeable improvement?
Yes, I think there must have been, because I think new sets must have come along at the same time as the new tanks. But I can't honestly... say much about that, because this was really the business of the regimental signal officer, I suppose, rather than taking the action. And I just don't remember.
While you were at Warminster, war broke out.
Right.
Were you aware of German equipment at the time, the sort of thing that you might be likely to meet?
We certainly were. Before we went to France, we went to France the following May 40. We certainly were aware of the German equipment we would like to meet before we went to France, but I doubt very much if we were at this particular time, in September 39. Or certainly, I don't think I was, perhaps some of my more enlightened brother officers were, but I don't think I was.
What sort of differences did it make, the actual outbreak of war, to sort of life at the camp?
Well, the chief difference it made to me was that at one moment I was a second lieutenant and the next moment I was a captain overnight. that was one. The second difference it made, I suppose, was that there was an influx of officers, new reserve officers and so on into the mess, and there was an influx of reserve soldiers into the tower, a regiment. Those things were private differences it made. But of course, obviously, part of that must have been the most enormously stimulating and exciting. I was going to say I'm ashamed to say, but I'm not really ashamed to say. Regrettably, we none of us really realised what it was all about, and this, I suppose, what we were soldiers for, and it was enormously exciting. But of course, we had the faintest idea what was going to happen, or where we were going to go, or what we were going to do, anything.
Was there any noticeable improvement in supply of equipment in the next few months?
Well, I think there must have been. But the thing I can remember mostly is that our transport establishment of transport as opposed to tanks went up enormously, and we then acquired all sorts of most extraordinary lorries, butchers' vans and bakers' vans and timber delivery vans and builders' trucks and goodness knows what, all came flowing in, requisitioned, I suppose, And it was my job as a technical editor to make these curious vehicles into military load carriers by welding on stanchions and building up sides out of timber from the local timber yard and and so on. And then painting them all roughly the same colour. So it was a very motley assembly of transport we had.
And you stayed at Warminster until you were sent to France?
We stayed at Warminster while this process was going on, yes.
All right. Thank you very much, General. It's fine.
Right.